Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Regina. And I, too, would like to welcome everyone to this program today. And this program, this Connect Education Workshop, is being done in collaboration with the Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network. And we'll hear more about them as the program as we move on with the workshop itself. And today's program is supported by an educational grant from Janssen Biotech, Inc., administered by Janssen Scientific Affairs, LLC. Now, we have, just to let you know about who's on the call today, we have over 155 participants on the call today. We come from all of the United States, in both urban, rural, and suburban communities. And we also have a number of international participants from Canada, Ghana, the Philippines, Taiwan, and the United Kingdom. So this is a global call as well. And it's a credit to each of you that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us to learn more about really focusing on caregivers and how to, and practical tips to cope with a loved one's bladder cancer. And this is part two of living with bladder cancer. And today's program is supported by an education grant from Janssen Biotech, Inc., administered by Janssen Scientific Affairs, LLC. And now, I'm going to move on and introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Ms. Yu Yang. She's a certified physician assistant, and she's a genitourinary medical oncology, University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And she'll be presenting updates on bladder cancer, the important role of the caregiver in communicating with the healthcare team, increasing role of telehealth, telemedicine appointments, and helping to manage your loved one's treatment, including adherence and follow-up care. It's my pleasure to introduce my esteemed colleague, Ms. Yang.
Ms. Yang. Thank you, Dr. Messner. Can everyone hear me?
Yes, absolutely.
All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Messner, for that great introduction. So like Dr. Messner said, my name is Yu Yang, and I am a physician assistant working in GU MedOnc at MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, Texas. So first, I'm going to give a brief overview of the current bladder cancer treatment. So I won't go into details regarding the statistics or clinical trial data, but I just wanted to give you a rough idea of what you may encounter as you accompany your loved ones on their journey of bladder cancer. So first of all, for anyone who's not familiar with the role of a physician assistant, you may encounter someone like myself, either as a physician assistant or nurse practitioner, who is also very involved in your care as part of your cancer care team. We work in collaboration with the physicians and nurses and other providers and clinicians in the clinic. So if you see that credential of APRN or PA popping up, that's one of us. Okay, so speaking of bladder cancer, so not all bladder cancers are created the same, and they're certainly not treated the same. So I will start with localized bladder cancers. So this means that the bladder cancer is still limited within the bladder and they're not spreading to anywhere else. And so under that umbrella, it's all categorized into non-muscle invasive and muscle invasive. If the bladder cancer is not muscle invasive, the treatment is typically local, which means the treatment is directly directed at the tumor itself. So this could be treated with transurethral resection of bladder tumor, or TURBT, or TURBT for short. And sometimes you may also see intravesical treatment with either chemotherapy or immunotherapy. This is often done with your urologist or a surgical oncologist. After those procedures, your loved ones may be under surveillance with imaging, urine tests, or more scoping with the camera inside the bladder to look for any new or changing lesions. If we see any recurrence, and if the recurrence is still limited within the bladder, a cystectomy to remove the bladder may be required. So in this process, it's very important to stay in a close communication with the surgery team to monitor for any complications like infections, bleeding, or other urinary symptoms, like what we call LUTS, L-U-T-S, or lower urinary tract symptoms like urgency, frequency, stream issues, incontinence, or hesitancy, or pain with urination. Some of those symptoms may be managed with medications. So it is very important to stay connected with the surgery team. Now, if the bladder cancer is muscle invasive but still localized within the bladder, we may see some systemic treatment coming in. So this may take the form of neoadjuvant chemotherapy, and after that, we may consider radical cystectomy to remove the bladder still. And so, first of all, if we are doing the surgery to remove the bladder, the surgeons would create a urine diversion, which is basically to create a new outlet for the urine to come out. And this will take some learning curve. So it's also very important to stay communication with the surgery team as you readjust to this new norm in your life. With the neoadjuvant therapy, that is often a chemotherapy, and I will go into more details about the systemic treatment in a minute. And then another option or other possibility that you may see is called chemoradiation. So this is a combination of chemotherapy with radiation. So I will also go into more detail after just in a minute. If the disease is metastatic, at the time of diagnosis, or if it develops into metastasis, maybe we see some lesions in the lung or other organs, then the systemic treatment becomes the main player in this scenario. There are different types of systemic treatment, such as cytotoxic chemotherapy, which is the more traditional sense of chemotherapy that you may have seen in TV or movies. We may also see targeted therapy, that can be given via IV or oral pills. You may have heard the term immunotherapy, and you may also encounter antibody drug conjugate. And sometimes if we see metastases that are small and isolated, we may also use local treatment to address those metastases, such as radiation, ablation with the interventional radiologists, or surgical removal of those lesions. Before you start any systemic treatment, we encourage people to let the care team know about any pre-existing health conditions, because sometimes the systemic treatments may be toxic to different organs of the body. So specifically, we may ask you about cardiovascular disease, such as high blood pressure, history of heart attack, or heart failure. We would ask about any history of autoimmune disease in the patient and the family. So this could be arthritis, inflammatory bowel disease, or things like psoriasis. Sometimes we also need to assess the neurological conditions that may exist in the patient, such as peripheral neuropathy, which may be related to diabetes. Some people may have hearing loss that can also limit or direct our treatment planning. Diabetes, like I said, is another thing that we need to monitor as patients go through this journey of treatment, especially if there's any complications like nerve damage or eye issues. So now let's get down to the details of possible side effects that you may see as we go into different types of therapy. with the cytotoxic chemotherapy, or what we call the traditional or the chemo, the real chemo drug, we monitor with labs of any blood cell counts that may change, so like anemia, low platelets, or lower white counts. So with anemia, you may notice some fatigue, lightheadedness, shortness of breath. If the platelets are low, you may see easy bleeding or bruising, and lower white cell count can weaken the immune system and cause the person to be more prone to infections. So during this time, as caregivers, you can provide balanced, nutritious diet with lots of fresh fruits and vegetables and high-quality protein, and also encourage the patient to maintain a good physical activity level as far as they can tolerate that. And it's also important to prevent any falls. So if there's any tripping hazards in the house, make sure that you remove them. And also everyone around the patient needs to be careful with their hand hygiene. So make sure that you wash your hands. We also monitor kidney toxicity with labs, but at home as caregivers and patients themselves, you can watch for any dark urine, reduced urine, swelling in the feet. We may want to encourage people to also drink lots of water to flush it out. And if we do see any, kidney damage, we also advise people to avoid any renal toxic agents such as ibuprofen. Another thing that we watch out for is liver toxicity. So sometimes we may see the three liver enzymes that we monitor that go up, and we call this transaminitis. So throughout the treatment, we always advise people to avoid alcohol as much as possible. We understand that sometimes, with holidays coming up, you may want to have a drink or two, but just take that in moderation. And also avoid fatty, greasy food. And if we do see liver damage on the labs, we also advise people to avoid acetaminophen. We watch out for any cardiac toxicity. So if you notice your loved one having shortness of breath, chest pain, palpitation, swelling in the feet, that could be a sign of cardiac toxicity. If they already have a cardiac baseline condition, that also warrants more attention. And if there's already a cardiology team involved, it's especially important to maintain close contact with them. And we also monitor for electrolyte imbalance, and sometimes we advise people to take oral supplementation with over-the-counter supplements. If you see your loved one is having numbness, tingling in their hands or feet, or ringing in the ears, or difficult with balance, then we make sure that you let the clinical team know, because we may need to adjust the dose of the treatment. Nausea, vomiting is very common with chemotherapy as well, and we commonly prescribe antiemetics to help with the nausea, vomiting. And if the appetite is affected, we encourage people to have small portions with frequent meals to still maintain a good calorie intake and nutrition status. Diarrhea can also be common. We typically just manage it with conservative approaches like maintaining good oral hydration. And sometimes we also order some labs to rule out an infection. And if the infection is ruled out, you can take some antidiarrheal like Imodium. Fatigue is very common with any systemic treatment, not just chemo. And like I said before, maintain good physical activities is the first advice we give people. And of course, sometimes we also need to do labs to rule out other possibilities that may contribute to the fatigue. But maintaining physical activities is the first step. Now, let's switch gear to immunotherapy. So you may hear about immunotherapy like pembrolizumab, or also called Keytruda, or nivolumab, also called Opdivo. So those are IV drugs, and they have their unique side effect profile. So the first thing that we let people know is that if you suddenly have severe diarrhea, that could be an immunotherapy-related colitis. So first, we need to rule out any acute infection and also encourage people to drink lots of water with electrolytes, but avoid sugary drinks. And we also try to get in contact with our GI colleagues because we may need to do a colonoscopy to see what's really going on. And sometimes we have to hold the treatment or even discontinue the treatment. So it's very important for the patients and their families to keep us updated of any new symptoms. Pneumonitis can also happen with immunotherapy because of the way immunotherapy works. It activates your immune system and it can cause an overreaction of the immune system. So pneumonitis typically presents with coughing, shortness of breath, and we would also, we would probably plan for a pulmonary function test and also get the input from our pulmonology colleagues. Rash can happen if it's mild, if it's just a little itchy, a little redness in the skin. You can take over-the-counter allergy pills like antihistamine. And also skin moisturizer is always encouraged, but we typically recommend fragrance-free ones. But if the rash is really severe, causing any bleeding, blistering, or even skin shedding, then that's severe and you need to go into the ER. And at the end of my section, I will also talk about some warning signs that warrant a ER visit. We monitor for thyroid disorder. So with immunotherapy, we typically see the pattern of a hyperthyroidism followed by the hypothyroidism. So this is kind of a unique scenario with immunotherapy. So we monitor the thyroid hormones, but symptoms may include higher blood pressure, faster heartbeat, anxiety with the hyperthyroidism phase. And when people move into the hypothyroidism phase, we may see more fatigue, dry skin, maybe some mild diarrhea or depressive mood. And this can be very easily managed with levothyroxine, which is a supplement for thyroid function. Now, the next category of the drug is called antibody drug conjugate. And one medicine that you may encounter is called enfortumab vedotin. We call it EV for short, and the brand name is Padcev. So two main things that are unique of this category of drugs. One is the skin reaction, and the second one is neurotoxicity or neuropathy. With the skin reaction, there can be some severe rash, particularly in skin folds, like under your arms, in the groin area, or behind the knees. If it's severe, we may see blisters, peeling off the skin. That's called Stevens-Johnson syndrome, and that's an emergency. We typically manage that with steroid holding treatment or dose reduction, and we very often refer people to dermatology for this. If you already have a dermatologist, it's also good to keep them on board after the symptoms subside. The neurotoxicity of EV is unique in a sense that it can cause sensory neuropathy as well as motor neuropathy. So numbness, tingling is common with the sensory neuropathy, but some people may start to have coordination issues and have falls or tremor in the hands. So when those things happen, you as the caregiver can give us the firsthand information of what's going on in any changes from the baseline of the symptoms. And sometimes we will have to hold the treatment or, again, reduce the dose. Now, the last category of systemic treatment is called TKI or targeted therapy. So you may hear erdafitinib. GI symptoms are also common, and we encourage people to use stool softeners if they have constipation or anti-diarrheal for diarrhea if the infection is ruled out. We ask people to monitor their blood pressure at home and work closely with cardiologists to manage the blood pressure medications. skin toxicity, specifically it's called hand foot syndrome, can present with dry skin, redness of the skin, or peeling of the skin, specifically in the hands and the bottom of the feet. And we encourage people to start using moisturizers when they start the TKI. Mucositis in the mouth can happen, so like mouth sores or sensitivity to hot and spicy food. We encourage people to use salt and soda mouthwash, and if it's still severe, we also prescribe mouthwash with pain medications. Now, other than the systemic treatment, you may also encounter radiation therapy. And the most common side effects of radiation would be skin irritation that's similar to a sunburn. So your radiation oncologist may recommend a moisturizer to start using when they start the radiation therapy. And if the radiation is targeting at the bladder, some people may experience bladder spasm, and medications can also help with that symptom. So as caregivers, when to contact your provider. If you notice anything new or worsening in the symptoms compared to baseline, such as significant increase in blood pressure, so we typically ask people to aim for the goal of less than 140 over 90 for the blood pressure. If there is severe rash, any new or worsening swelling, frequent falls, mouth sores or ulcers, severe diarrhea, or even not severe, just new onset diarrhea that lasts for several days, then make sure that your team is aware of that. And some warning signs to go to the ER would be if there's uncontrolled pain, like affecting daily activities, unstoppable bleeding in the urine or stool, or even just nose bleeding that doesn't stop after several minutes. Severe headache with nausea, blurry vision, that could be a sign of very high blood pressure and can cause stroke in very severe cases. Any chest pain, shortness of breath, like difficulty with just even gasping for air. Any asymmetrical leg swelling, if one side is much bigger than the other side, or any color changes. Fever, our cutoff line at MD Anderson is 101.4. That requires people to go to the ER, especially if they're on systemic treatment. Any skin sloughing, like the skin is peeling off and it's like wet underneath. It's not just like growing new skin. Then that's severe. You need to go to the ER immediately. Severe diarrhea, like I said, 6-7 times a day or more than that. And any signs of dehydration, like dry mucosa or fever. So the caregivers are the main advocates for the patients, as well as the patients themselves. So when you get in contact with your oncology team, especially when you meet a new oncology team, save the phone numbers of the clinic, and sometimes they may also give you an after-hour number. So save those in your phone in case there's anything that comes up. And also report any changes in the health status, not just the symptoms, but also the functional status. Like if your loved one is not able to do something that they regularly did before, that's also a change that requires, that warrants reporting. So to help manage your loved one's treatment, including adherence and follow-up care, so definitely monitor for any possible side effects and communicate that with your clinical team. And we have some patients also keep a calendar or a planner for the appointments. And in our system, we have everything online in the portal. So make sure that you keep an eye on the portal for any new appointments that may come up. And sometimes so it would be very helpful when you meet a new oncology team, you have a record of any treatments that your loved one has already received including the beginning and ending dates, the kind of medications they received, and did it work or did it not work, any side effects that they experienced. That would be definitely very, very helpful. And I just wanted to mention that we understand that we're all human beings. We have a life outside of the cancer world, okay? So providers, you as caregivers and patients, you all have a life outside of the cancer and the clinic. So make sure that you take care of yourself. And with that, I will end my session and transition to the next speaker.
Thank you so much, Ms. Yang. That was an incredibly informative and wonderful presentation. Lots of great information for our participants. I think people are very appreciative of that. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well, so thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Guadalupe Palos. Dr. Palos is former Clinical Protocol Administration Manager, Office of Cancer Survivorship, University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center, author and researcher in caregiving, healthcare disparities, and survivorship. And Dr. Palos will be addressing stresses, challenges, and rewards of caregiving, including long-distance caregivers, managing family, friends, partners, and traditions, coping with holidays, birthdays, anniversaries, and special occasions, and remembering to take care of yourself, self-care, and stress management tips. It's my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Palos.
Good afternoon to all on today's call, and Dr. Messner, thank you for the opportunity to be a member of this esteemed panel. As you're going to learn, each panelist addresses a specific topic that involves the patient and their entire family during the bladder cancer journey. Extensive published research indicates the stress on families increases during times of significant occasions, such as anniversaries, birthdays, or even the upcoming holidays, such as like coming up the Thanksgiving and other holidays. Ms. Yang gave us an excellent detailed foundation on the current state of bladder cancer. And she touched on the vital role of caregivers and how they can help in managing all the challenges associated with bladder cancer. So I'm going to pick up on that theme and just carry on and share some thoughts with you. Families and caregivers often feel they must keep up with the wonderful traditions they associate with special events. And like many of us, they often struggle to keep up with the traditions. Families may find themselves struggling to keep up with preparing those special events and the traditions that went along with it, and also conducting caregiving activities. Families also know that they have to complete activities associated with daily living, like grocery shopping, working, going to school, and other key functions. Trying to maintain multiple roles on a daily basis can be challenging for a caregiver who lives with a patient or is close enough to see their loved one. But what happens when there's a geographic distance between the patient and their caregiver? Is long-distance caregiving even possible? One caregiver asked me this question: how can I be a caregiver if I don't live with my family member? And then ended our conversation by stating firmly, that cannot be done. Well, I believe it can be done, and I'm going to share some thoughts on that. For our discussion today, though, I'd like to propose a simple definition provided by the National Council of Aging of who is a long-distance caregiver. Briefly, it is a person who lives an hour or more away from a loved one who needs the care. There is evidence that long-distance caregiving is rapidly growing nationally and globally across countries. We know that approximately 7 million caregivers are long-distance caregivers. Long-distance caregivers may not only refer to other states or countries. You don't have to just be a long-distance caregiver in that sense. This type of caregiving may be necessary when one lives in a rural area or even in a large metropolitan area where it takes more than an hour to get from one side of town to the other side of town. There's no doubt that distance poses a barrier to caregiving, but there is growing evidence that even those who are long distance, the caregivers that is, provide essential support to their loved ones. For example, long-distance caregivers provide advice or financial support, and they help guide decision-making. Caregivers are critical and helping, especially during a crisis. These are examples of rewarding experience for the caregivers, and there are many others that we don't have time to go into today. However, the roles and responsibilities of the caregivers change throughout the caregiving experience, and these changes certainly increase during special occasions. So it's not surprising that as those roles and responsibilities change, the emotional and physical health of a caregiver will also change. Providing care to an individual with chronic illness and disability is generally viewed as a significant life stressor, and its effects on the health and well-being of the caregiver have been studied over the last four decades. Family caregiving has been associated with increased levels of depression and anxiety, higher use of psychotropic medications, poor self-reported physical health or health status, and compromised immune function. There can often be feelings of frustration or guilt. For example, there may be thoughts of, I'm not doing enough, or I can't go to that, you know, festive party that I wanted to go to because I don't want to be gone that long. And that those kinds of feelings especially come up during holidays when there are so many special events going on and activities and parties and gatherings. Now, caregivers then can also become uncertain as they go along this journey about the changes in their loved one's physical and mental health. And Ms. Yan gave a wonderful detailed explanation of all the challenges that the patient can face. But for this part of the lecture today, or session today, we're going to focus on our caregivers. The combination of all these thoughts that I just mentioned can contribute to the stress and distress of the caregiver, and even more so when there is distance between the patient and caregiver. There is no doubt that a caregiver will need to adjust their routine when providing care for a loved one diagnosed with cancer, and also prepare for special events. I'd like to begin with one critical adjustment on strategies to deal with these, or to cope with these feelings and thoughts and events that are coming up. This is an adjustment that is often overlooked by the caregiver and at times even the providers. This adjustment involves practicing for the caregiver to practice strategies that promote self-care. Self-care is always important in the caregiving experience, and even more so when caregivers have to deal with long-distance caregiving and holiday celebrations. And I'll go into that a bit more later. Well, now that you all or all of us on the call understand these circumstances, what can we do to be proactive caregivers? So I want to share a few strategies that you may be able to use. There's about eight of them, and I believe it'll help you plan effectively, be proactive, and be prepared. So the first thing I always encourage our caregivers and families to do as a group is develop a caregiver preparedness plan. And that's much, any of you that have been through tornadoes or hurricanes or tsunamis or whatever, know that you have to be prepared when these kinds of events happen. These are, they change people's lives. And that's what's happening in this cancer journey. It's changing people's lives. So with that plan, the very first thing also that would be important is to communicate. That is, be informed. Maintain close communication with the patient's providers, the care partners, and other essential team members. Perhaps you can schedule a regular time to call and talk to them. And remember to use or learn tools such as MyChart to access medical records and send messages to your cancer care team. This is an easy and efficient way, once you learn how to do it, to really be able to communicate effectively with your team. Find out who is willing to help. These can be neighbors, friends, or other relatives, or they can even be people from church-based organizations or local self-help groups. But identify that safety net. And especially if you live long distance, if they can be your eyes and your ears in caring for your patient. Now, this may sound like a lot of work, but you'd be surprised how handy it comes. And that's to keep a logbook where you can record conversations with other caregivers, providers or even insurers or people that you deal with, Medicare, all of that. Keep track of who you spoke to, when, and what the outcome was. It can trigger memories later on when you go back to the logbook and try to recall a conversation or a medication or anything of that sort. So along with that, though, also keep helpful numbers handy. So you can make a list of the pharmacist, the primary care, primary provider, the care team, the cancer care team, friends that are willing to help anyone who is involved in the care of your loved one. And give that list to as many different people on the team as you can. And you might also want to keep a copy for yourself. We're so, you know, don't get so busy giving them out to everyone else that you forget to keep one hand for yourself. You can put it on the refrigerator or someplace where you can see it immediately. And those of you who are long-distance caregivers, try to book your regular trips to your loved ones ahead of time. That way you're not scrambling for tickets at the last moment, because that also adds to your stress and to the confusion and chaos that goes along with being a caregiver during special occasions. If you are a long-distance caregiver, when you do arrive to the home of your loved one diagnosed with bladder cancer, do your own assessment. And you can assess the following areas. The personal hygiene of your loved one. Do they look disheveled? Do they look well kept? Do they bathe? All those things that we normally do on a day-to-day basis that we take for granted. Look at the level of activity and mobility of your loved one. Are they staying in bed? Are they sitting in front of the TV? Are they trying to walk back and forth, maybe from the kitchen to the bedroom? You know, those are important triggers. If you note that they're just sitting there, then you can encourage them to take baby steps, because remember, fatigue is something that's very common, not only among our patients, but the caregivers. So try to keep moving. The nutritional needs are important, so kind of take a look at the groceries in the pantry and refrigerator. Are they all processed food? Is it an empty refrigerator? Or does it show that there's nutritious snacks and things of that nature? Look at the condition of the home. Is it clear that it's well organized? And then, most important, look at the safety needs of the home of your loved one. Are there falling hazards, smoke detectors? Are there secure locks on the doors? And does a trusted neighbor or friend have a key to the house in case of emergencies? So finally, and most importantly, I'm going to go back to the caregiver. Keep tabs on your own physical and mental health. There's a term called caregiver burden, and caregiver burden occurs when the caregiver ignores physical symptoms such as fatigue, interrupted sleep, weight gain or loss, increased colds and infection. They can also, caregiver burden also occurs or the symptoms occur when there's like emotional emotions such as anger, frustration, anxiety, or sadness. And sometimes that sadness can even be called the blues. So you want to be looking out for emotional symptoms as well as physical symptoms. And these symptoms are going to fluctuate in the caregiver depending on the loved one's status and at what point they are in the journey of their cancer experience. Don't ignore these signs for you as the caregiver. They are red flags. They're like a temperature of 104 degrees or a blood pressure of 180 over 100. You would do something immediately for those types of signs. So those ones that we spoke about, the weight loss, etc., those are symptoms that, you know, don't ignore them, because if you ignore them for a long period of time, it increases the risk of caregiver burden. And this occurs when a person is in a state of stress or distress for a long period of time. The combination of stress, burnout, and having all the responsibilities can often lead to abuse of alcohol or other substances. So if you do note those types of situations happening, go and seek help. It's critical to practice self-care for your body and mind. So how do you do that with your friends and your neighbors and others? Well, one successful strategy of a few, the first one is set boundaries for your family, friends, and yourself. Don't be afraid or reluctant to say no, you'd rather not attend that function, or no, you can't do this extra trip for them. It's okay not to answer the phone immediately or text somebody back immediately, and it's okay not to consistently check your emails. you can make a schedule of those things and just try to get them all out of the way early in the morning, in the afternoon, or at night. Don't try to keep up with all of that all day long, because that's another stressor for yourself. Give yourself permission to listen and to express your feelings. Listen to your feelings and don't be afraid to express them. You can cry, you can grieve, and you can talk about your sadness to help clear your mind and provide relief. You can also find ways to express emotions such as joy, love, laughter, because these things, even though they sound like, I don't know, they really help you, strengthen you during your journey. You can also establish a sleep ritual to help cure your body when it's time to rest. So that means turning off the smartphone, the laptop, the television, anyone that's a distraction or anything that's a distraction, tune it out. You can try to take small breaks, deep breathing. You know, you don't have to be a fancy yoga instructor to do that. Just practice some deep breathing. You can do yoga if you'd like, or just even listen to music. We are finding out through evidence-based strategies that music can really help with stress. You can try journaling, nothing fancy. You can just jot down your thoughts or feelings. You can reach out to others. Ask about local or national resources available in person or online. Dr. Chisholm, Ms. Smith, and Dr. Messner are going to provide valuable information on the resources that are available. Move your body. It matters. I can't tell you enough. Even 5 or 10 minutes will make a difference. If you feel guilty or fear being away from your loved one, remind yourself that by taking care of your own health, you, the person you're caring for, will reap the benefits of being a healthy caregiver. And when needed, please don't hesitate to seek professional help for mental health services, such as those that will be discussed later. Thank you so much for allowing me to share these thoughts with you. And Dr. Messner, this concludes my remark, and I'll return the program back to you.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Paulus. That was just a wonderful presentation, just absolutely wonderful. And so many tips for people and suggestions. That I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well, so thank you. Thank you so much. This is a stellar presentation, as always. And our next speaker is Dr. Stephanie Chisholm. And Dr. Chisholm is Director of Education and Advocacy, Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network, and she'll be addressing Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network BCAN free programs and services, and she'll be sharing with you their bladder cancer support line as well as their website information. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Chisholm.
Thank you so much, Dr. Messner. And it was just wonderful to follow such phenomenal programs to really highlight what's available for treating bladder cancer and also the role and responsibility, but also the self-care that's needed to be a caregiver for somebody who is experiencing bladder cancer. And it just kind of reminds me of that saying that you hear every time you put on get on an airplane, the flight attendant is always telling you to put your own oxygen mask on first, because if something happens to you, it's really important that you won't be able to do what you're doing for your loved ones. So that's just a wonderful lesson to remember. And I do want to point out a few things. The Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network website has an enormous amount of information, both on all of the aspects of treating the disease, but also about survivorship. I encourage everyone to visit us at bcan.org, and you can find a copy of our Bladder Cancer Basics Tips for Caregivers. We will send you a copy, or you can download it for free on the website, which has a lot of the suggestions that were just provided to you in written form. And many other things. One of the things we started this year was a call center with cancer care. And if you are a little distressed or worried and you want to also find resources for yourself or your loved one across the country, you can call our toll-free number. It's 833-ASK-4-BCA or 833-275-4222 and speak to a licensed clinical oncology social worker, and they'll be able to help you find resources in your community. So I'm so excited that you are joining this call and encourage you to visit again, bcan.org. For almost 20 years, we've been here for the bladder cancer community, and we appreciate all that caregivers do for their loved ones when they're diagnosed. Thanks so much.
Dr. Chisholm, that was just outstanding. It's a wonderful presentation and such a wonderful resource, and we're so delighted to have this bladder cancer support line in conjunction with Cancer Care. And so that's really been terrific. So thank you so much for all that you do and for BCAN providing those services the past actually 20 years, and will continue to do so as well. It's just a wonderful resource. For any of you who aren't familiar with it, please take advantage of it. And our next speaker is Ms. Dina Smith. Ms. Smith is an oncology social worker, and she's our caregiver program coordinator at Cancer Care. And Ms. Smith will be addressing Cancer Care's free programs and services, our Hope Line, and website as well, and other information. It's my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Smith.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. As Dr. Messner introduced me, my name is Dina Smith. I am the caregiver program coordinator at Cancer Care, and I am also an oncology social worker. So as Dr. Chisholm also mentioned, we here at Cancer Care do help man and operate Beacon's helpline, where we can get people connected to services and resources local to their area or even virtually. We do not answer any medical questions, but we can give advice on how to best communicate with your medical team. And beyond the Beacon website and hotline, at Cancer Care, we also offer general resources and services to people beyond bladder cancer who are dealing with other diagnoses. In addition, as the caregiver program coordinator, I design and facilitate workshops and services specifically for the caregiver population. We always record all of our workshops, and you can find all of those recorded workshops on our website, cancercare.org, where you can search under topic, and then under topic, you will click on caregiving. If you're having trouble navigating the website, you're also more than welcome to call our hotline, 1-800-813-4673, where you can always speak with an oncology social worker between the hours of 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. In addition to those services that we offer, Cancer Care also has other types of services, such as resource navigation, which you may know more commonly as case management. Cancer Care also offers limited financial assistance and limited copay assistance. You are more than welcome to call that 1-800 number to see if you qualify. In addition to that, we also offer educational workshops, such as the one that you're on today, as well as wellness workshops provided by our oncology social workers. In addition, if you are a New York or New Jersey resident, we also offer live one-on-one or Zoom group support. We do have three caregiver support groups based out of New York and New Jersey. So again, if you're a resident, please call to sign up. And last but not least, we do also have a wonderful free podcast that you can listen to. It's called Cancer Out Loud. And there are many podcast episodes designed specifically for caregivers. Again, it's called Cancer Out Loud, and you can go to our website to listen to those or anywhere where you listen to your podcast. And finally, we also offer helpful, easy-to-read publications, which also have many articles designed specifically for caregivers entitled such as Advice for Caregivers, Caring for Yourself When Your Child Has Cancer, Advice for Caregivers Handling Burnout, Advice for Caregivers, How Can You Help Yourself, etc., etc. Once again, if you are having trouble perusing our website, cancercare.org, please call our hotline, which is 1-800-813-4673. And with that, I'll turn it back to Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Smith. That was a wonderful presentation, wonderful resources, and thank you so much for your wonderful presentation. And now we're going to move on to the Q&A. I'm going to ask Regina to explain to you how to queue up for questions, and we're going to take as many questions as we can. Regina?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we'll take questions from the web only, and you may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
And let's see. This would be a question for Dr. Palos. Do you have any tips on helping a loved one deal with their thoughts about recurrence?
Excellent question. Excellent. That is one of the most common thoughts that cancer survivors have, whether they're stage one or with an advanced disease. Everyone's always worried, not only the patient, but the family members. The best thing that I would recommend on this is it's going to vary, of course, by individual, but just ask, you know, if they bring it up, don't go away with it and say, oh, everything's going to be fine. Don't worry about that now, because that's, in a way, discounting their feelings and their thoughts. If you just maybe can just sit down and just say, well, tell me a little bit more about that, you know, or tell me, what are you worried about on that? And just give them a chance to verbalize it. Sometimes people just want to talk about it. They don't necessarily want anyone to fix it, so to speak, or to really give a wise answer. They just need someone to listen. So I would just recommend just sitting down with them, you know, if you want to get a cup of coffee, get a tea, go for a walk, and just say, tell me more about your thoughts, you know, and that'll open it up. And then you will feel like, hey, you really are listening to me and the worries that I have. It's hard to do, but once it's open, then you kind of create an air of permission and freedom that it's okay to talk about some of the things that aren't so positive all the time, because we know that there's ups and downs with cancer. So, you know, that I think would start opening up some opportunities for all different types of dialogue.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And a discussion from Ms. Smith. My dad is hesitant about joining a support group, but I think it would be good for him to meet and talk to other people with a similar diagnosis. How can I bring this up? Subject without him shrugging it off. So should I join him if he decides to go?
That's a great question. So I would definitely encourage your loved one to look at Cancer Care's online support groups. So there's a difference between our online support groups and our live support groups. Our live support groups are via Zoom, and they are for only New York and New Jersey residents. But our online support groups are typing based. They are on a secure platform. Each group is monitored by 1 to 2 social workers. Each group is very interactive. It's a safe community. And it's a great way for people to kind of dive into the group counseling world without having to show their face, without having to live talk, but still receiving great support. If you think that your loved one is not interested in that type of support, you know, kind of exploring what they're worried about, seeing maybe if they should start off with just one-on-one with a counselor or even through peer matching services. And then to answer the third part of your question, from my understanding, and at least how I run my group, I actually run the general New York caregiver group. We do not allow anyone besides caregivers to be in the group. So no loved one can sit in with a registered client in the group, because think about it, they might want to share their honest thoughts and feelings about how they feel about the diagnosis without their loved one being around. Maybe they feel like that's the safest space where they can feel heard and feel less isolated. So I would encourage you to think about all of those different platforms to use for your loved one, but remember that it's probably best and they will get the most out of their counseling experience if you let them do it alone.
Thank you very much. And I'm going to ask our speakers to provide takeaways at this point. I'm going to start with Ms. Yang to go first, please. Just a takeaway that you'd like people to take away from the program today.
I think this has been a wonderful session, and I even learned some that I can share with my patients and their loved ones as well. So I think it's important as your loved ones go on this journey of treating and fighting bladder cancer. But at the same time, you as their champion also need to make sure that you are taking care of yourself. So while you're monitoring for any side effects, toxicities, or the health issues of your loved ones, you know, we and the patients will also need you to stay healthy as well. And I think it's very important to know your limits. You know, ultimately, at the end of the day, how you allocate your time and energy is up to you. And I think, I hope you feel empowered to ask for help. So like we have heard in the session today, there are plenty of resources out there and there is a community to help supporting you and your loved ones.
Thank you so much. Excellent. Dr. Powers, takeaway.
Sure. I'd like to encourage caregivers to visualize themselves as a cancer caregiver warrior. I found this statement on an online website that kind of expresses this thought, and I'll share that with you. Caregivers are warriors, fearless, courageous, and passionate about protecting those they care for. Remember those words when you start feeling really overwhelmed. I am fearless, I am courageous, and I am passionate about caring for my loved one. And then one last note, also then say those words and practice being a warrior about your own health. I know it's a hard journey. I know it's exhausting sometimes, and I know it can bring you to tears sometimes. But try to, you know, if you give yourself a pep talk like this, I am passionate, I am courageous, and I am fearless, it might give you a little bit of a lift to keep on going. Good luck to you all, and thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much. So that was wonderful, Dr. Powers. And Dina Smith, Ms. Smith, please, your takeaway.
Yes, absolutely. I second everything that Dr. Palos said. Everyone on this call is absolutely a warrior. But if you are still feeling like you need some support or you need some guidance, please give Cancer Care's hotline a call. There are oncology social workers there ready to help and ready to get you connected to any type of resource that you may need at this time. And thank you so much.
Thank you so much. And I want to thank our participants as well for asking such great questions. We were not able to take everyone's question, so I want to comment on that. For those of you who have a question, those who had a chance to ask a question, and for those of you who have a question yet to ask, I would suggest that in both categories that you go back to your treating healthcare team. You've learned a lot today. And just go back to your treating healthcare team and actually ask the question that you asked or wanted to ask on this program today, because you've learned things that you can then share with your healthcare team, and you can learn, may ask the question slightly differently, but you'll have learned something, and that's really important. I just want to stress that's so important. Also, something that we've mentioned during the call, I think by Ms. Ying, it's really important to have the phone numbers of your healthcare team on evenings, weekends, and holidays. You know, those are times, and particularly with the holidays coming up, you need to know how to reach your healthcare team during those times. And so be sure to ask that question of your healthcare team so that you know exactly, you know, how to... what numbers to call at those times. Seems during the day isn't the problem. It's those evenings, weekends, and holidays. And we have a lot of big holidays coming up now, so it's very important. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today. I want to thank you all a very fine day, and I really appreciate your being on this call today. Thank you so much.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect.